Welcome to the Colorado Review podcast, featuring prose and poetry from both recent and archived issues of the journal. Once a month, a rotating crew of editors and staff members are invited to read and discuss some favorite poems, stories, and essays as published at Colorado Review. I'm Kylan Rice, joined today by staff member Cole Konopka and Stephanie Lennox, who is the author of The Business, a recent poetry release from the Center for Literary Publishing. In this special episode of the Colorado Review podcast, we have the opportunity to hear from the author of one of our associated publications. Cole and Stephanie, thank you so much for joining me. It's a pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great. So, this is sort of a special episode because typically what we do on the podcast is read through content from prior issues. This time, though, we have the luxury of not only speaking with the author in person, Stephanie, but also looking at a full-length collection published by the Center for Literary Publishing here at Colorado State University, which is associated with Colorado Review. We were talking earlier, Stephanie, about sort of the dryness to the air. I mean, we can't help but talk about Colorado, I guess, to a certain extent, in terms of the fact that we're associated with the Review. So where are you from originally that is so affecting how you're interacting with the environment?
My transition.
Here?
Yeah. Well, I'm from Salem, Oregon.
Okay.
And this is a place where mushrooms will grow in the carpet if you let them. So.
You got to be vigilant about those mushrooms and those mold spores, I'm guessing. So. So we've got the book, the Business, here. Mm-hmm. And could you tell us just broad stroke, general overview? What should an audience, what should a listener know, sort of before we leap into a good-sized chunk that you've generously agreed to read out loud? Anything
sure.
that the audience should know beforehand?
Sure. Well, what you should know is this is a book that I started when I was working as a secretary in an office, and so a lot of these poems are inspired by my daily interactions with coworkers and fighting with fax machines and so forth. So a lot of it is directly inspired by my work life.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, we've got a list of poems here that maybe we would like you to sort of work through. Do you mind starting with that?
And
we'll just go one to the next, get a nice sort of cross section of what the book has to offer.
Excellent. Thank you. So I'll start with the title poem, The Business. And just a little bit of a background about this poem. I was working on this collection, and when I was in Arizona, there was a visiting writer, Tony Hoagland, and I'm in love with his work. And so I sort of snuck up and said, hey, I'm working on this collection of work poems, and I start talking with him about it. And he said, you know what would be great is if you found ways to get to look out at the world and see the office in the world outside. And this is sort of where that poem came from, of finding the structure of the workplace, not just within the cubicles and offices that we normally associate with work, but within all realms of the world. So this is The Business. The tractor in the field does not take things personally. It is not affronted by the way wheat bends before it, all that luscious weakness. There is no mind, just a motor, a servitude of parts churning politely together. The oily smoke is only smoke, nothing more. If steered by the farmer's hand off track into rutted earth, it will not cry out, oh, thou hast sorely done me wrong. No, it takes a person to take things personally. Whatever the farmer has planted, it will cut. It will devastate the field into harvest. When time comes and the farmer abandons it in a far corner of the field, it feels nothing. How can anyone take things personally out here, beneath the blue, unambiguous sky? The tractor cannot choose to stop or go. It cannot hate the hand that guides it. Do not feel sorry for the blade, or for the mice that flee from it, or for the slow, dumb grouse. It should have known better. There can be no tragedy here unless you see it. You, sweet, pathetic ladder of bones, leaning against that blighted tree. The next one I'll read is The Task, inspired by a supervisor who would ask me over and over to do the same thing. It goes somewhere different, I think, in the poem itself. The bowl is empty and it must be filled. I will set a reminder to remind you. I will remind myself to tell you this. Remember, you must fill it if it is empty. This is your job. I will help you to remember the bowl, how it must be filled, not just today, but in perpetuity. And if it is empty, I will remind you that the bowl, empty, needs to be filled. Filling the bowl must be your first task. And I will help you. Remember, the bowl tends toward emptiness. You have responsibilities. You must prove yourself. Will you fill it? The next poem is On Metaphor. Your boss is an ass. Your pay, shit. Each day feels like two, every task pointing to another. The 9 to 5 multiplying paperwork. No wonder you're tired. Two bosses on your back. The boss of what is and the boss of what could be. Of course you don't get paid more for taking on new work. It's the price, you say, of competence. Your job is a ship propelling you forward. It is a lead weight, a bird. No one knows what's in your briefcase, not even you, but you carry it back and forth, part of the uniform, a symbol of duty. A raise is not just more money. The coffee pot is a sacred monument. One floor above, one floor below, someone like you worries over his retirement, rearranges pens, reads a headline of national progress, then turns to the photo of a car wreck. On your own, you have no authority. Each decision you make must be approved by another, and for that, you're glad. Sharing the weight if something goes wrong, but also the glory if all goes right. The business of making something else for someone else. Endlessly generous, the work of work. The next one I'll read is part of a series of prose poems that features a character named Big Chief. This one is Big Chief Considers the Exact Location of His Heart. Who has time to care about people's feelings? Chief wants to know. This is a workplace, not your grandmother's house. No one asks him if he's feeling like going to meetings. No one asks him if he really wants to pay his bills. If you want to have feelings, have them on your own time. That's your business, not mine, thinks Chief. There is a budget to balance and schedules to keep. A heart is a tool for pumping blood, for keeping the body warm, and it is a mistake to call it the seat of love. Who thought of that crap? Chief wants to know. Gladys, Chief calls out. Figure out who came up with that crap. About hearts and love. The next one, The Babies Are Coming. The babies are coming. They are almost here. They are here for our jobs and blood. They'll lasso us with umbilical cords and turn us blue. Oh, mothers and fathers of the world, they are here to replace us. slinking and slurping in dirty nappies, gumming the doorknobs of office buildings, and they will not be satisfied, not with a breast or a song, not with truckloads of toys, not until they have slobbered the whole town and its citizens, until they have smashed all industry like a block castle to smithereens. The babies will have us in suits and skirts hamstrung with love. We will give them names, and they, in turn, just learning to speak, will point their chubby fingers at the door and spout the first word, which will be surrender. They will take everything, having survived the worst, forced from their dark world into this one we've created. Asleep on the laps of executives, they will rule the world from the highest floors. Squinting into daylight, our mess of streets and parking tickets, the dented trash bins, for this they will make us pay. The world that sounds nothing like the low drumming of blood we promised them. And the last one I'll read is Hopelessly Rubbing Two Pigs Together. It's not an easy maneuver to find two pigs and rub them together. I said maneuver. You must not lose hope. If you are confident, it can be done. Select the perfect swine and get to work. Inspiration comes from those who seize the pig and the other pig. Many have tried and failed. Give everything you have to the pigs and to the hopeless endeavor of rubbing them together. Nothing is hopeless.
Thank you so much, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie.
That was Stephanie Lennox reading from The Business, which was published in 2015 by the Center for Literary Publishing. So maybe we could begin by talking about just sort of broad stroke issues that the book brings up. This is obviously this book called The Business. It's about work. You know, you were saying earlier that you know, your conversation with Tony Hoagland inspired you to think about work outside of the cubicle space. Do you mind talking for a minute just about why you perhaps believe it's important to have discussions about work in the realm of poetry, which is often seen as sort of like this life of the mind, sort of like leisure hours, so traditionally like strumming on the lyre in the pasture. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, yeah, I think I began writing this book because I felt I needed poetry to address my life. And I think for most of us, we spend so much of our lives in workspaces and in places that are not of our choosing. And I think there's a line in my book where I say that we spend more time in our rolling chairs than in our own beds. Mm. And it made me think that why isn't poetry addressing this major portion of our lives? And I was inspired by the work of Tom Wayman. He has he's an editor of several collections of work-related poetry. And when I came across them, I'm like, this is what I need. This is what I've been looking for. And so I set about to try to write an entire collection that filled that gap for me, that hole of experience that I felt poetry hadn't fully addressed. Mm.
I mean, and you do mention, so let's see, you situate yourself at one point in relation to Philip Levine,
yeah.
Who's, of course, that great poet of work in America,
right?
And you begin the collection, actually, with an epigraph by Philip Larkin, who is obviously less associated with work, but I can, a few poems come to mind where he is talking about, like, the laboring class, you know?
Right.
And so were you intentionally sort of situating yourself within a larger context of, like, of poetry meditating on work?
Definitely. I feel like with whatever I'm writing, I am trying to find my people. I was trying to find my colleagues. Who are the people that are working in the same vein, who are doing the same thing, who can be, I guess, my points on a compass to help me find my way through it through my own poems.
Yeah.
How is the what is the relationship of that then with your first book?
With my first book?
Like the transition between the first book and Who Are Your People and mm-hmm. and where that's come and these reference points as you talk
yeah,
about that.
And tell
yeah.
us a little bit about like the title and
of my first book. Yeah. yeah. So Congress of Strange People was published in 2012 by a small press that's up in Oregon, Airlie Press. And a good portion of that book, so I am sort of a project-based poet, so a good portion of that book is written in the voices of other people. So mm-hmm. there are a lot of dramatic monologues or persona poems. And I did feel that as I was working on that book, I was finishing off that book when I was working in this office space. And some of my later poems in that collection do sort of bring in the idea of work. Last night at the reading, I read The Amazing Cannonball Couple from that collection, and it was me sort of processing people and their jobs and what they have to go and do every day, and I was thinking, here are these two people who load themselves into cannons as their job. They get paid to do it, and I get paid to go sit in a chair and type and file paperwork. And what does that mean, and how do we survive even when it seems like what we do is not that risky? And so I think I was starting to lean in that direction with my the tail end of my first collection.
You know, we got a little taste in the selection you gave us of sort of the classical elements of these poems as well. So, mm-hmm. and by classical, I do mean like sort of Greek and Roman mythology, right? Like there are several poems that address mythology. I think you've even got a poem called On Mythology
yes,
in the
I
collection?
Do.
Great,
yep.
yeah. And so, and the book itself, you know, is structured, is divided into sort of like classical ode forms, genres,
mm-hmm.
right? Like
Stasimon
the epode, and
the
epode and that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. So I'm just curious, maybe you could talk, we've talked a little bit about some of your more recent or contemporary colleagues, but I'm interested in maybe thinking about your decision behind situating this book sort of structurally
mm-hmm.
in terms of a larger, more classical poetic tradition,
mm-hmm.
especially considering just how rooted in the now this collection is.
Right.
Maybe you could talk about that, but I'd also be interested maybe, and maybe this is too many questions all at once,
mm-hmm.
but I'd be interested in, like, obviously you're a poet deeply concerned with the daily, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do people spend their long, brutal, nasty, short hours of life doing, right? Like, and yet, the impulse to mythologize
yes.
is an impulse towards fantasy,
uh-huh.
and it's an impulse towards dream, and it's an impulse towards, like, the heroic and the epic and the totally out of the ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And so how are you balancing these two, or have you done any thinking about maybe overlaps or dissonances that arise out of this kind of contrast? So two things for you. So just under the umbrella of mythology,
sure, sure.
if you could maybe talk about sort of the fantastic versus the daily, and
mm-hmm.
also sort of like larger historical considerations of like
sure.
situating the book.
Sure. Yeah, so I think when it comes to the references to mythology in the book, a lot of it comes from feeling like I'm going to this boring day job, and yet the battles that I'm waging are epic. And coming home and trying to tell this story and trying to make sense of the arguments and disagreements and territorialisms that happen within an office. And I felt like there was more than going on. I do think you're right. I am a poet of the daily. But there was something bigger about the daily stuff that I was dealing with. And I feel like office places are an intersection between the day-to-day and some of the larger concerns. Like, where we work determines where we live and who we associate with and what cars we drive.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it has much larger impacts. It defines for us our place in life. And so I think I was really intrigued with how the day-to-day affects the bigger picture. And so by bringing mythology in, I love mythology. But I've always been amused with how petty the gods are and how how ordinary they are in their arguments. And so for me, it seemed to be a natural connection between the pettiness of the gods and the pettiness of my coworkers. And so to bring those two together just made sense to me.
And, you know, and maybe we've lost something along the way, you know, like during these times when these myths were first being formulated and these gods, these great entities were being also portrayed as very like daily and human, mm-hmm. and with foibles of their own. Maybe we've somehow like in our society drifted away where we kind of binaristically oppose the two, mm-hmm. when really that there's this kind of like enmeshment that's really beautifully spoken to in your collection between mm-hmm. like the fact that these daily working moments are sort of like shot through with, you know, they're sort of trailing clouds of glory, so to speak, if we're gonna like bring Wordsworth into it, which I will always do.
Oh, good. Good for you.
But,
well, and I would say that it's not that we've lost sight of the gods in our daily life, but I think our gods have shifted. Mm. Our gods are our celebrities now. Mm-hmm. We look to them, the Kardashians are the mythological characters of our lives, where we look to them and their epic foibles, and they're the ones that give us perspective in the day to day.
And they're the ones we rejoice in. Their
in their failure, foibles. Yeah, exactly. The ways they fall and fail, yeah.
So you know, another thing that I was thinking about is considering some of the more granular structural decisions, mm-hmm. In the collection. I mean, I would be interested in talking a little bit in a moment about what it means to write a collection of such sustained focus.
Right.
But I find that it strikes me that you're a poet interested in formal decisions on the level of the poem as equally as you're concerned with formal decisions on the level of the book, mm-hmm. right? And so just thinking about like some of the poems even that we didn't read, there's a lot of there are rhyming poems in this collection. There mm-hmm. there are like sort of classical, almost classical odes. There are poems that deal with anaphora, you know, repetition. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could think, you could speak for a moment about like your identity as a formal poet, versus maybe an identity of someone more in the free verse tradition.
Right, right.
And you also teach creative writing at
right.
Willamette University, and
right.
so I imagine that this is a topic that probably comes up quite a bit in your pedagogy.
Right.
And
right.
so maybe you could maybe talk about how you address it there and how you address it in your own work.
Right, right. I mean, free verse is how I... No, I'm going to correct myself. I was going to say free verse is how I started, but no, formal verse is how I got into poetry as a kid. Mm-hmm. You know, I was raised in a very conservative church, and so the hymns and the Bible verses, there was a lot of formal poetry in sort of the ceremonial and ritualistic parts of my religious upbringing. And so when I sat down as a child to write poems, they always had those elements.
Right.
I was very influenced by Robert Frost and by the Baptist hymns of my childhood. And it wasn't until later that I started playing around with free verse and seeing what I could do with that. And I feel like people tend to do all or nothing. And I don't see the separation as much between free verse and formal verse. I love formal poetry, especially formal poetry that sneaks up on you, that has those formal elements that don't immediately call attention to themselves. And so I guess I'm always looking for what tools that I can use in my poetry. So so when it comes to free verse or formal poetry, I don't really make a distinction between those. I just sort of do whatever I need to do for that poem to feel like I've done justice to the idea.
In terms of formal verse, there's something very much of the work of work involved with that.
Yeah,
you know, like
yeah,
just
yeah.
Harking back to that poem on metaphor. You know, poems sort of, at least in my experience and famously, call attention to themselves as this labor of leisure almost.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if that's one of the reasons you're using those tools, those formal tools, like by thinking about the poem as a concerted effort.
Sure, you know, sure.
Versus just like some utterance.
And that makes sense to me. I love counting syllables. I love making sure everything lines up. And I think part of that is connected to my days as an administrative assistant, organizing, putting things in files, making sure everything's orderly, you know, all my little paper clips are lined up. I think there's something about that meticulousness of my work life that carries over into the poetry. I love how things can, how you can organize the just chaoticness of your life into these neat stanzas. And I feel like the more chaotic the topic, the more exciting it is for me to put them into those neat boxes and see what I can do with them.
You can take the office out of the office manager, but you can't take the office manager out of the office, something like that.
I was interested in this book. Obviously the business, it's about business, but in many ways is pushing off of business like a starting block to get going in a lot of ways. So now that you are not in that world anymore and in a very different world, what are some of the things, well, do you see yourself as continuing to write out of that methodology of pushing off something or some new methodology? Or if so, what might you push off of now?
Right. I'm fairly consistent in the way that I write. I tend to write about what obsesses me. So when I was firmly in the workplace, I could not get away from it. It was obsessing me. I couldn't figure out why all I could dream about and all I could think about was how annoyed I was by my workplace. So I had to find a way to process that through poetry. And even though I am not in that actual work environment, there are so many things about the workplace that carry over into academia. I mean, we still have stinky fridges. Do you guys have stinky fridges?
The stinkiest.
Yeah. See? I mean, you can't escape the stinky fridge. And I think that fridge is a symbol for who takes responsibility and who's supposed to be cleaning up after other people. And I'm fascinated by that. So there's a lot of that that carries over into academia. But now what I'm obsessed with has to do with family, family life, the life after work, like the people you come home to and how you how you live with them. I'm obsessed with domesticity and how much I hate it and children and how difficult they are, and even monogamy and how stressful that can be, and all those aspects of life. So I feel like that's sort of the starting block that I'm working with right now with my newer stuff.
I'm seeing volumes by like hours, you know,
the
9 to 5.
I'm beginning to realize Congress of Strange People very, very much deals with my childhood and questions of identity. Mm-hmm. In writing in the voices of other people, it's sort of how I found my voice. And so then from there, I move into the work world. And it just seems like a natural progression. I'm heading into the family life and and children and all that.
Something of like Virgil's Georgics or like Ovid's Metamorphoses in this like in this long consideration of like the day, the human day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Works and days, right? Last question, perhaps something that Cole and I both were interested in, is what it takes for a poet to write sort of like a concerted. You mentioned you were a project-based poet.
Right,
So that's it sounds like it just comes naturally to you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts on the difference between sort of like the one-off poet and the project poet, or maybe what it means to occupy a mindset wherein you can sort of deliver a sort of a book-length project based on a single theme. That to me, that would take a lot of patience, a lot of like, or a lot of passion, one of the two.
Sure. And for me, projects come out of, my projects are a reaction to my tendency to have tremendous and debilitating writer's block. Mm. And so I give myself these projects to almost distract a part of my brain. Like, okay, I don't have to write a poem. I have to write in response to that thing my coworker said the day before. Or, as in my first book, I would take a little entry from the Guinness book and I'd write in response to that. And it, these little prompts keep me from dwelling too much on what I'm trying to accomplish. And otherwise, I feel like every time I sit down to write, I don't know if I can do it. I don't know if I can write a poem. And so it's a way of distracting myself from, I guess, my desire to write. Mm. Does that make sense? Yeah.
No, that's nice. I experience that a lot. Like that,
you know? Yeah. We all have to distract ourselves from the fact that we're writing so we can enjoy writing or
exactly.
something like that.
Exactly. Otherwise, you agonize over it. And there's the editor. I think in some ways, defining a project gives that editor who's always on my shoulder something to worry about so that it frees the creative brain to do the work that I really want to do. It's like, here, editor. Think about the structure while I take care of the words. And
there's something in that of, actually, one of your poems references the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And there's something of, like, you can't look at that which you most want to look
yeah,
at.
Yeah,
yeah. So you have to look away, and if uh-huh. you look back, it'll uh-huh. disappear back into hell,
right,
you know?
Right, so right.
You sucked back in
yeah.
the beloved, so to speak. You know, because I am greedy, and I know Cole is greedy, and I know our listeners are greedy. I wonder if you could leave us with one last poem of your
okay.
choice.
Yeah.
I think that'd be really nice to hear.
I'm going
to
read the one about the stinky fridge.
Excellent.
Attention to whoever left fish uncovered in the office fridge for 3 weeks, think of others. There are many ways to start a war. Take, for example, his assistant's short skirts, or the sign on the bathroom door that reads, "If you sprinkle when you tinkle, be a sweetie, wipe the seedy." No wonder no one likes poets. Meanwhile, paper clips disappear into a parallel universe. Your stapler each morning is turned ever so slightly to the left. It's psychological warfare. Soon enough, all whispers sound like your name. You are blamed for the broken coffee pot, and as a result, it will be months before the others look you in the eye. How hard is it to replace the toilet paper roll? Isn't that what we mean by community? Above the cubicles, little flags of dominion, little flags of surrender, but no one will tell you which is which. The intern says something about economies of scale. Because of this, we avoid him in the lunchroom. He won't last long. Here, the accountant's perfume creates a hostile work environment. Someone is going to HR about the dead plant in the corner. Some rules should never need to be explained. In the afternoon, the microwave chimes and someone distributes handfuls of popcorn, a bag of fluffy and butter-soaked aneurysms we all can share.
That was Stephanie Lennox reading from The Business, which was the winner of the Colorado Prize for Poetry and published in 2015. Thank you so much, Stephanie.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you both. If you wish to know more about the book, or if you wish to read some of our other titles at the Center for Literary Publishing, that can be found online at coloradoreview.colostate.edu. You've been listening to the Colorado Review podcast, which can be found on iTunes and at Colorado Review's website, coloradoreview.colostate.edu. Also online, you can find selections from recent and archived issues of the journal, blog posts, reviews, and much more. This podcast is made possible by Colorado State University and the Center for Literary Publishing. Thanks for listening.